This episode is brought to you by Rockstar Energy Drink. Be honest, are you procrastinating by listening to this podcast? It's okay. You just need Rockstar Focus. Choose from three delicious flavors, each crafted with ingredients for an ideal energy and mental boost, like Lion's Mane, 200 milligrams of caffeine, and zero sugar. Visit rockstarenergy.com to learn more. At least 75 milligrams of caffeine has been shown to help improve attention.
And now, everybody, MC Search. MC Search. MC Search. MC Search. MC Search.
Search will never stand still.
Hey, what's up? It's your boy, the other white meat. MC Search, Search Says Podcast. I'm very thankful that this man hung out because I wasted about 2 hours of his time, and I apologize for that. So he's going to give me a solid 30, a hot 30, ladies and gentlemen, Chris Hansen.
How you doing?
I'm good, sir. How are you?
Thanks for having me. How's everything?
Thank you for being
here. It wasn't
here.
2 hours. Just a
it feels hour. Like, you know, 2 hours, 3 hours. You know, I like to, you know, I'm a Jew from Queens, so I'm going to exaggerate on wasting your time. So, but I want to kind of start a little bit at the beginning, and we can fast forward through everything, because you and I have a mutual love for the city of Détroit.
Absolutely.
I spent some time there on the radio, being very proudly the very first non-African-American to host WJLB. You go up listening to JLB.
Yeah, JLB and GPR and
the Electrifying and Mojo.
Yeah, exactly, all that.
What was it like growing up in Detroit?
Detroit, I was in the suburbs, but, you know, we did get into the city frequently, and we moved there, my family and I, in 1968. So it was the spring and summer after the riots. And we came from Chicago, where both my parents were from. My dad got transferred there. He was in the auto industry. And it was really a nice childhood. I mean, we were a great suburb, great subdivision. You know, as a young adult, you know, spent some time in the city listening to Marvelous Marv, your midday DJ on WGPR and all that. And working, you know, in summer jobs where I had exposure to, you know, urban life. And so it was great. It was wonderful. And went off to college at Michigan State and then came back and was a reporter in Detroit for about 10 years before I came out here to New York.
Right. So I'm sorry that you couldn't get into Michigan and had to settle for Michigan State. By the way, that is a Michigan joke, FYI.
You know, I did get into him. You know, I did get into Michigan.
Oh, you did?
I had the choice.
This was just...
My father was irritated with me because I, for a minute, and I explained to him that, well, a couple of things. One, that I thought Michigan State was a better broadcast journalism school.
Which it is.
It's not. It worked out for me.
It's Michigan's, not a better acting school.
Michigan's a fine, fine school, obviously. My sister went there.
Because we have couldn't get into Michigan State, obviously.
That's my joke. She doesn't take kindly to that.
No, I'm sure. Most people from Michigan don't.
But you have to understand the rivalry between Michigan and Michigan State. It is fierce.
I'm very well
and especially
aware.
This year, when both football teams, both very good, will go into this matchup on October 30th, likely undefeated.
There's
and
a
that's
going to
be
chance.
That's going to be a heck of a game.
Yeah, and are they playing it in Big Blue, or are they playing it in?
They're playing it at Michigan State in East Lansing. Yeah.
Okay, so that's going to be an amazing.
Oh,
game.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's going to be incredible. So do guys like you get the grass? Do you get to walk on the grass for games like that?
I have.
Have not, you pulled the Chris Hansen card?
I've done it before.
Will you do it for this one?
Probably not. I'll probably watch it so I can focus on it at home. I think it's going to be a night game. It's TBA right now, but we'll probably go up there. We've two kids are still in school there. So we may go up for a tailgate and then come back and watch it so I can really see it. I had season tickets up there for years and kind of got out of the habit of going just because, you know, we travel back and forth between New York and Michigan. We have a home in Michigan and a place right here in the city. So when the kids were younger, when my second son was still there, we would go a lot. And then the younger two kids started, and we just kind of got out of the habit of getting to the games. And but we watch them.
Right.
You know.
And you did a lot of investigative reporting. That was really your specialty in Detroit. You know, I just watched the Netflix special on Maserati Rick. But there's a lot of really great work that you did, especially around the Coleman Young era, and kind of unearthing a lot of the kind of nepotism and the issues that were going on in the city. And a lot of it kind of created a lot of that racial divide. How were you received during those days when you were kind of doing
that? I was very well received. You know, I got along with everybody as a reporter then and as a correspondent and journalist now. You know, I had a very unique relationship with Coleman Young. I adored the man personally. I gave him a heart attack occasionally in news conferences and in interviews, but we had a mutual respect. And to understand Coleman Young is to understand what it was like to come up from Black Bottom in Detroit and then to ultimately become mayor of the city. And, you know, I'm sure along the way, I know along the way, you have to give and take and you have to be a street fighter in a way. And he was. But he deeply cared for that city. He deeply cared for his constituents. And along the way, there were investigations and there were things that happened. And I pressed him on those things. One specifically was we learned that he was an investor with a shady character who was a civilian police deputy chief, Kenneth Weiner, in South African Krugerrands. Now, this came at a time after the mayor was ceremoniously arrested protesting apartheid in Washington. And yet it comes out that he was investing in these Krugerrands.
Amazing.
So I asked him about this on a Friday news conference, and he says he doesn't want to dignify the question with a response. And so it goes around the room again. I ask him a second time, and he doesn't answer. And a third time I asked, and he got irritated with me. He goes, Hansen, I told you I'm not going to answer the question. I said, all you have to do is explain to people why you did this. He said, all you have to do is not ask the motherfucking question. So you can imagine what that was right. Leading the news with Bill Bonds on that Friday afternoon at 5 o'clock. So
no,
he finally exploded, you know.
No, and but that's not the only time he exploded on you. I mean, I think his nickname for you was motherfucking Chris Hansen. Like, I think there was several.
I don't know about
that. I think there was another issue where it was right after the Cougaran question, where there was the issue with the, not the Maserati, Rick.
White Boy Rick.
White Boy
Rick Wershe Jr.
Right,
so
right.
Rick Wershe Jr., as you know, from the Netflix documentary that I was in that so many people have seen, was a young guy who was a police and FBI informant who then went into the cocaine trade himself at the age of 16, 17 years old. And we're all over this. Like white on Rick, as they say back in the day.
Right,
and, you know, it was a hell of a story, you know, and I didn't name him that, but I found out that's what his nickname was. And of course, that caught fire right away. And so we stayed on top of the story, and I get a tip one day that they're going to raid the mayor's niece's townhouse. Now, the mayor's niece was married to Johnny Curry, who was in prison as a major cocaine dealer, bigger, arguably, than Rick. And so when they raided that townhouse, looking for evidence having to do with an investigation, the FBI finds Rick lying in bed naked with Kathy Volson Curry, the niece. Now, imagine that story.
Right.
So I call Bob Berg, great guy, who is the press secretary for the mayor, challenging job, even on a good day. And I said, hey, you know, I just want a comment from the mayor or the mayor's office regarding White Boy Rick being in the bed with Kathy Volson Curry when the FBI raided the townhouse. And he says to me, well, you're not going to do a story on that. Right? I said, hell yes, I'm going to do a story on that. I'm, you know, the live truck's putting the mast up right now. And, well, we'll have no comment on that. But it was, you know, it was a crazy time to be a reporter in Detroit, and a great time to be a reporter, a very competitive time to be a reporter. And we battled it out between the stations and the newspapers at the time.
And it doesn't seem that it ever slowed down. I mean, even through when I was there through the Kwame Kilpatrick.
Oh, yeah. Arguably it got even busier. I mean, I wasn't there as a reporter during the Kilpatrick years, but Kevin Dietz, who's a family friend, a longtime friend of mine who's a reporter there, you know, lived the Kwame Kilpatrick story for years. And the saga and the things that happened and the, you know, the alleged corruption and the, you know, the federal investigations. I mean, that was nuts.
Yeah, it was
that
crazy.
Was gangland
I mean,
stuff.
I was involved in it. My name is mentioned.
Yeah, I know.
In the pagers. But was the Rick and the work that you did as an investigative reporter the catalyst that brought you to New York? Was that kind of
I think it was a combination of things. You know, when I was a reporter in Tampa, Florida, before I came to Detroit, I got to know the Miami bureau chief pretty well, and he ended up being a vice president of NBC News, and they were very good in those days at, you know, identifying younger guys and gals who were in the business and bringing them up to the network. And so it was Don Brown who I met as a reporter in Tampa when he was Miami bureau chief, and ultimately had the chance to go to NBC in 1993. And, you know, I think a lot of that work was helpful. I think the Chambers brothers, the drug case where the guys had their the videotapes of their ill-gotten gains, you know, that was a big story. I got those tapes. And obviously the White Boy Rick story was on the reel, and so many other things. You know, we were able to go overseas. We traced cocaine from the jungles of Bolivia to the streets of Detroit. I mean, we were able to do a lot of very important, compelling stories, and that fortunately caught the attention of the network.
If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
This episode is brought to you by CarMax. CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because CarMax believes you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car they sell has CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure, with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive. CarMax, the way car buying should be. Start shopping now at CarMax.com.
How did your wife feel about you going from Detroit to New York? I mean, one of the things that I tend to, and again, this is, I can only share this with a few people because, you know, my wife and I are from Queens, right? And I told her, oh, I'm going to go to Detroit. You know, my plan was I was going to stay in Detroit. I was going to go to Detroit, do the morning show, be there for 20 years and retire. Like, that was my plan.
Yeah.
I can tell you that my wife was not happy in me going to Detroit. She was not happy. And my kids were miserable in going to Detroit. And if it wasn't for, you know, fortunes outside that I created, they were a misery. You were settled in Detroit. You had a family in Detroit. You had really built a...
You know, one son who was, you know, very young at the time in Detroit. My second son was born on the East Coast. So it was... I was settled there and had a great life in Detroit. And, you know, could have gone to the network for 2 years and come back and anchored the news there. And that's a wonderful career. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing wrong with that and nothing necessarily better about being at the network. But I just felt that I had more to do. And 2 years into the network stay, I was offered a chance to go back to one of the stations and anchor. And I was very flattered by that. And yet I didn't feel that I had accomplished enough at the network level. I mean, I was just 2 years into it. I just started to understand it. You know, when you go from a street reporter, even if you consider yourself a good street reporter who had some anchoring experience, it's a different world. I mean, it's your first year, it's like a rookie year playing sports. I mean, you can wash out very easily if you're not all over it and if you don't live it. And there's a big difference between doing stories that are 2 minutes long and rat-a-tat-a-tat and telling the story even live and doing a news magazine story that's 10, 15, 20 minutes or an hour long. That's a different style of writing. It's a different style of laying down audio tracks. And I had people surrounding me that took the time to teach me how to do that. I didn't know how to do that when I went to the network. I had, you know, Jeff Zucker, who was then the executive producer of the first show I worked on now with Tom Brokaw and Katie Couric and Elizabeth O'Connell and Paul Greenberg. These people sat in a tracking booth with me and said, calm down, slow down. You're telling a story. This isn't just boom, 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 boom. Mm-hmm. And, you know, without those people, I may not have made it. You know, a lot of, you know, Tim Uhlinger was a great producer who I worked with right off the get-go. I mean, those people all helped me.
Yeah, no, you found your tribe. You know? You really right. were able to find your tribe.
And, you know, people very loyal and to whom I was very loyal. But, it, you know, it's a first year of hazing to get through it all right. in many cases.
Hazing. What was one of the things that, like, what was the haze?
Probably an extreme word to use.
What water did they make you carry on? Did they send you to Junior's for cheesecake bare feet?
Nothing like that. But, we had a show that was very new and did not have a library. We had nothing on the shelf. So literally on Friday, Saturday, we decide what story it was I was going to crash, what I was going to turn around for the following Wednesday. I would get on a plane on Sunday, whether it was Michael Jackson or Polly Klass or the Unabomber or whatever it was, I would go work around the clock many weeks. Shoot Monday, Tuesday, get it on the air Wednesday night, fly back to New York, go to the staff meeting, get patted on the head, literally crash Friday, Saturday, and get ready to go on Sunday. And that was, you know, for weeks at a time, that was my life, which was great. It was amazing.
For you, your wife must have been miserable.
At the time, we had two little kids, and you know, it was a different sort of life than some of the people who worked 9 to 5, but yeah. It was a good life, you know. I was glad to be 34 at the time and be, you know, fairly fit. But I remember I had to have a hernia surgery that first year. And literally, you know, I took the time off, but with staples in my gut, getting on a plane with a, you know, shoulder bag. And it's time to go, man. This is go time.
And speaking of go time, I mean, obviously, you're very, very well known for, you know, To Catch a Predator.
Sure.
What was the impetus of that idea, and how did that kind of come about?
I was at Dateline. It was 2004, and I learned about Perverted Justice. A friend of mine who was a reporter in Detroit told me about Perverted Justice, which was at the time an online watchdog group that had decoys who went into chat rooms posing as kids, and if a guy hit on the kid, they would post that guy's information, if a meeting was set, on their website. And occasionally law enforcement would get involved in those cases. So I figured, well, if we could take their ability as decoys and combine it with our ability to wire a house with hidden cameras and microphones, it could be pretty compelling. And so I pitched it just as a regular story for Dateline. I had no idea that it would become a series or that it would become what it did. But we did it in Bethpage, Long Island, in February 2004. And I'm thinking, driving out there, what if nobody shows up? What if I've just wasted tens of thousands of dollars of the network's money? And with that, the producer calls and says, there are two guys heading over here in 45 minutes. Where the hell are you? So I get there, and before it was over, 17 guys surfaced in that investigation, including a New York City firefighter. Mm-hmm. And so that aired months later, and predictably, it got a lot of attention. It was very compelling. We were taking people inside the commission of a felony.
I know.
And so we did it again, the second time outside of Washington, D.C. And it was then that we had the opportunity to work with law enforcement in California, in Riverside County. And it became clear in those two first investigations. Now, law enforcement did get involved. They did make some prosecutions. In both, the firefighter was prosecuted, and a number of people were prosecuted arrests out of the Herndon, Virginia case. But it was more difficult after the fact. They had to get our stuff. They had to figure out a way to prosecute it, and we had the opportunity to work with law enforcement, where law enforcement was getting the transcripts at the same time. I could do what I needed to do. Law enforcement could make their arrest, make a prosecution, and it worked better. It worked better socially in terms of our responsibility. And quite honestly, it worked better as a television show because there was some resolution. It was frustrating to see these guys twirling an umbrella walking down the street after being, you know, confronted by me trying to rape a child.
Yeah. One of my one of the episodes I remember, and it's still kind of, I get a little choked up when I think about it. A rabbi showed up.
Yeah, that was in Herndon, Virginia.
Yeah.
David K.
I knew him.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. I knew him from New York. I had met him at an event at my shul. I remember seeing it. And I mean, obviously, beyond shocked and stunned. But almost to this day, I still hear his stupid ass, like, excuse mm-hmm. and his apology, thinking that he was going to apologize and right. walk out.
I know I'm in trouble. You know I'm in trouble. I don't want to get into any more trouble.
I'm just going to walk out of here.
Yeah.
And then they put the cuffs on him. And I got to tell you, to your face, I would have put a fucking bullet in his head. If I was outside that door, it's such a, in Judaism, we call it a shanda.
Yeah.
A lashon hara. There's so many words that come to me that is, he disgraced our religion. It was just so beautiful. It was so beautiful what you did and how you handled it, but it was so disgusting.
He walked into that house like he owned the place.
Oh, yeah.
With a spring in his step, which is what was so offensive. Now, this is a Wednesday around noon.
At noon, yeah.
In a beautiful suburb of Washington, D.C., essentially.
Kid came out, waved hi.
Yeah, it was Del Harvey at the time.
Right.
She posed as a boy and said, hey, come on in. And he came in with a spring in his step. I mean, happy, like happy. And
happy dappy.
Yeah. And then he saw me, and you could see the shock in his face.
Yeah.
And he had sent naked photographs of himself, photographs of him performing sex on another man to who he thought was a 13-year-old boy. And when I confronted him with those photographs, he went to go grab it. It looked like he was coming after me. He really wasn't. He was going after the photos, but it turned into a tussle. And, you know, like, we didn't have 100 copies of those photos or couldn't get them from the chat transcript. So that was what that was all about. And ultimately, the FBI went after him, arrested him. And he had a bench trial in federal court. And the judge was so outraged by the case that he went beyond the sentencing guidelines. And I think the guidelines were like 5 years and sentenced him to 6.5 years in prison.
Yeah.
And he's been in and out since then because he's violated his parole and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah. And he's become an addict. And you know, as big as the Jewish community is, it's very small.
Yeah.
And especially on the East Coast. I know you got to go. And I want to also just say that one of my personal favorite moments is your episode on DJ Vlad. And I want to tell you why. I think Vlad is a piece of shit. And I'm not a fan. He lied to me. He's lied to a lot of people. I think he's a culture vulture. But I want to ask you just directly. You said to Vlad, well, I hear that you are an informant for the FBI. Is he an informant for the FBI, or were you just pulling it?
What I said was, he had asked me a question, and I knew where he was going with it. And,
right.
And I said, you know, people say a lot of things. Some people say that you're an informant for the FBI. Now, you know, what I know isn't important in terms of content as it is, I called
context,
him out because he was saying things that were tabloid. He was asking about tabloid rumor stuff, some of which, you know, just wasn't true or relevant. But that's right. I sat down for the interview. He can ask me whatever he wants. If I can't handle it, I shouldn't do the interview. I handled it just fine. And people have come up to me and said that. I don't have a problem with him. He asked the questions that he thought were interesting. I answered them in what I thought was an interesting way.
And you did an amazing job.
Well, when you do something for 40 years, you start to get okay at it, you know. So I have no beef with him at all.
I will say to you, my friend, that you are the Rakim of journalism. And to me, Rakim is the greatest MC of all time.
Well, I appreciate that.
And
that's
I
kind
find
coming from
you
especially.
Chris Hansen, to be the greatest journalist of our generation. And I'll tell you why. And it's really simple. And it's really, Rakim is great at what he does because he makes the complex simple. And you are great at what you do because you make the complex simple. You are able to dial it down so that I can understand it and that the world can understand it. And we need more Chris Hansen.
Well, I always say, fortunately, I'm too stupid to realize there's anything I cannot do.
Chris Hansen, ladies and gentlemen, his podcast,
Predators I've Caught with Chris Hansen, is out everywhere you can get your podcasts. We've got a couple series on Discovery Plus, Onision in Real Life, Unseemly, the Peter Nygaard story, YouTube, Have a Seat with Chris Hansen, and a bunch more stuff coming out soon, including more Predator investigations.
Love that. Love that. And thank you so much for your
thank
time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
All the time that our most valuable commodity at this point in our life is our time. And I thank you so much for spending it
with
me.
My pleasure. My pleasure.